KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Carabello here with Leah Murray on the day of the eclipse, which we're not going to lead with, Leah. We're going to...
What? No, I feel like everyone does.
No, we're going to switch it up here. So we, as you well know, talk about politics a lot. And one of the key fundamental parts of voting is who's on your ballot, how does the ballot work, what's the art and the science to the ballot. So we're going to talk about two interesting stories that will impact our ballots in 2024, but people are probably not paying much attention to them. First is an event that is happening in Utah. I'm going to read the headline that grabbed our attention from today, and it says Utah will host a presidential debate next week, but not the candidates you expect.
So I love that.
We've been talking a lot. I think most of our listeners probably have been tracking that Utah will have a presidential debate closer in October, closer to November's election. But we are also holding the Libertarian debate in Utah. It's going to be at the Doubletree Hotel in Salt Lake City, and it's going to be on April 19th. So this is not a major party, if we define the major parties as Democratic and Republican, but the Libertarian Party has had a strong foothold in American politics for generations.
Yeah,
it's been around
for
quite a while, right?
Right. No, I do feel like, what do you think about this? I feel like back in the 70s, like the Libertarians were, you know, like some cool alternative.
Right.
And maybe didn't have a ton of people. And Ron Paul was adorable when he went around the country saying the things that he said. But I do feel lately they've been more, does that make sense? Like, you know, kind of more plugged into affecting maybe Republican Party politics a little bit.
Right. So there's always been a relationship between a Republican philosophy and a Libertarian. Not always. They meet on the dark side, you know, at the dark side of the moon where the ACLU meets the Libertarians. But there's always been a relationship. But I think now it's fair to say that the Republican Party is having a fight for its center, its soul. And the Libertarians become, do they become a spoiler for this? Do they become a bigger factor? I also think this is a particularly interesting conversation for those of us who live in the Intermountain West, because I feel like Libertarian, the fences make good neighbors approach to the world is a Western approach to the world in many instances. So there are three choices for Libertarian candidates on your ballot this year. One is a former police officer. One is a tech entrepreneur. And the third one is an ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Right. And I have never heard any of their names.
I haven't either.
So I'm not sure who they are. But you know what's kind of interesting? So I will just share this with you, Mara. Like up at Weber State University right now, we do not have a College Republicans chapter, but we do have Young Americans for Freedom and we do have Young Americans for Liberty, the latter being more libertarian. The former is a little bit more conservative. Does that make sense?
Right.
I just wonder if a little bit, maybe those students know who these people are, who this police officer is or who this tech entrepreneur is. And a little bit, too, we barely have any college Dems because Gen Z's kind of like over it.
Yeah.
And they're not interested in either of the two major parties. I don't know. Maybe this is the moment.
So it's also interesting because the ballot has been accessed by the Libertarians in 39 states. So again, the theme for this opening segment is there is more going on to the ballot than just really looking at Republicans and Democrats. And certainly one of them will be likely to be the victor.
So let me ask you a question. So the Libertarians may be the longest running third party, right? So we were talking about it. I know them at least going back to the 70s, right? So my question is, another third party that just said they wouldn't have a candidate is the No Labels third party. Mm-hmm. And a little bit, I wonder, Mara, what do you think about this? Like the No Labels didn't even have a candidate, got maybe more news about not having a candidate, you know what I mean? Like
right.
The conversations around it, than the Libertarians, which has been a solid third party for a generation or so. And they actually have candidates.
Yeah, you want to know, for me, the bad news is right now, political speech is really tied to financial prowess and contributions. Libertarians have sort of been very ideologically driven and maybe not as money driven, although they've had some big names and we pay more attention when they gather big names, but no labels had some heavy hitters associated with it. So another sort of attempt at the ballot this year that led out with a big name is an independent in RFK or Robert Kennedy. And he also, again, to our conversation of the dynamics going on the ballot, Robert Kennedy is making a pretty big play. In fact, last week we reported on KSL at Night that his national average in polling right now is around 9%. That's a major showing for a first-time candidate. Now, one comes in with the name Kennedy.
When your dad is Bobby Kennedy.
And comes in with what is largely perceived as a right issue in an anti-vax point of view. So he's blending some really disparate principles right there. And last, 2 weeks ago, he brought to his ticket a woman who has no political experience, but has a lot of experience in raising tech money. So right. What you know is it looks like they may be a well-funded campaign.
Yeah. And what's interesting about Robert Kennedy Jr., one, he's on our ballot. So by the way, somebody who's at the Hilton or the Doubletree later this month will be on our ballot for the Libertarian Party. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will be on our ballot as well.
And so far, that's true in only Utah.
That's
like,
right.
We are a unique state. This will change. Both of these parties will access more ballots. But Utah right now, we have four parties who have qualified for Utah ballots. And that's the most in any state in the nation.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is interesting, I think people assumed that Kennedy would pull from Biden, right? He'd be a spoiler, a third party spoiler for Biden. But actually recent polling, just like you talked about, he tends to come in with that anti-vax. And then this weekend, Mara, he decided to say that the January 6th Capitol attack wasn't really an insurrection. If he gets elected, he's going to appoint a special counsel to investigate whether prosecutions related to the attack were politically motivated. So he's basically coming in and going, right, I don't think it was an insurrection, and any one of the hundreds of people who have now been run through the system of law enforcement for their part in it, I'm going to have a special counsel investigate to see whether that was politically motivated, those prosecutions. Also feels like he's coming in for Trump's voters, right?
So the most fascinating part, I think, from a political science point of view, is that whenever there's a spoiler, whenever there's a third party, Leah, you and I have known who he's trying to spoil. Robert Kennedy is fascinating because much of the political discussion is, who is he spoiling?
Right.
And his answer to the question is politically brilliant, in which he loves the moniker spoiler. He takes that on and says, yes, I'm a spoiler, and I'm a spoiler for Trump, and I'm a spoiler for Biden. So he's playing it equally so. I will point out to Utahns, just to make this double, triple how you vote. In Utah, it's likely that if you are not for Trump, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're not for Trump, then for sure Kennedy is a spoiler to Trump here. My rationale, Trump is going to win Utah. So there is no spoiling it for Biden.
He's spoiled.
The Democrat part of him spoiled his ballot.
Right.
So really it's a matter of taking away from a Trump vote here. So that will be an interesting consideration for those who want an alternative to Trump. And so I think he becomes a spoiler. Needless to say, the point here that we will continue to talk about is our ballot is going to be really dynamic and so, so interesting. And I think we're going to keep seeing these nuances play out. We're going to stick, Leah, with what's going on in Utah. And we want to talk about pay. Who gets paid what? Are we a part of the norm or is Utah way out of whack? So stay tuned with us on KSL at Night.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Mara Caraballo. And you may not know this, listeners, but Mara and I are women.
What?
If that weren't obvious, we are. And I think one of the things that we think about is, well, at least I think about, it's kind of the role of women who are professional women, right? In, you know, the industries in which we find ourselves. Right. And I will just share that I once ran a gender pay gap study up at Weber State, just kind of looking to see. And as it turns out, there was one, right? And so you kind of look at that and you go, oh, okay, you know, even in a place where we all have terminal degrees, right, this is happening. And there are always explanations for it, Mara, right? But it is something I'm interested in. And I saw an article talking about how Utah actually has the second largest gender pay gap in the nation. When we talk about the pay gap, what we mean is in Utah, women make 75 cents on the dollar that a man makes. So you like hold the man, you know, male pay, if you will, as constant. That's the dollar. And in Utah, it's 75%. And the article we were reading said something like women worked for free, if you want to think of it a different way, until March 12th of this year, right before their pay starts to kick in.
That's right. And, you know, that's the big picture. That's totals being divided, right? It's not taking a lot of nuance into account. We'll talk a little bit more about what the nuance is. And let's also, I think it's important at the start of conversations about disparity, I think it's important to note that in this study that we're going to talk about, they only found that 3% of employees were discriminating intentionally against women, meaning 97%, the vast majority of people, it's unintentional. And that's where the interesting conversation happens. It's not to ascribe blame, but to say, how could we do better giving every person who wants to work the opportunity to reap as many benefits as the person sitting next to them, regardless, right? So in this instance where we're talking about gender, we do have one of the leading voices from Utah business community with us, Derek Miller, who is the president and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber. Derek, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Mara, and thank you, Leah. It's good to be with both of you.
Derek, I just want to tell you, you're very brave to come on this conversation with two women, and I do appreciate it. I'm assuming that you've seen the study that I'm referencing about the gender pay gap. Do you want to dive into any like mitigating factors? Does that make sense? Or any of the explanations or the variables that might, if we started controlling for, things get a little bit better?
Well, maybe I had to say from the very beginning that it didn't take much bravery to come on with both of you because I'm an advocate for you. This actually started for me my second day on the job at the chamber, which just happens to be 6 years ago, almost to the day when I opened up the newspaper. Well, I say opened up, I'm an old timer. You know how it works nowadays. You look at it on your computer screen, but I saw an article. And this was 6 years ago, and we were number one in the nation for the pay gap. And that's not number one in a good way. That was number one, as you pointed out, meaning at the time we had the largest pay gap. And I only share this story because I remember sitting there reading this, and I thought, my first thought was, oh my gosh, you know, we tout Utah as number one in so many ways, but here's a number one that we shouldn't be proud of. And then my second thought was, somebody should do something about this. And then my third thought was, wait, I'm somebody. I'm the president of the Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
And so I walked across the hall to one of our affiliate organizations that both of you know well, which is the Women's Leadership Institute, run by Pat Jones, who's just an icon in our state. And I sat down with Pat and I said, Pat, let's try to do something about this together. And that something was creating what we called the guidebook for Utah businesses in closing the gender pay gap. So we've been, Pat and I and both of you and many others, engaged in this effort for a long time.
I love that right there. The path that you took to solve the problem was to create a guidebook for private business, right, Derek, in an effort to help them first probably acknowledge the problem and then think about best practices going forward to address that gap?
That's exactly right. And, you know, all of us live in and work in different spheres of responsibility and influence, right? And I just recognize, you know, as the president of the Chamber of Commerce, my sphere of influence and responsibility was among these private businesses and what we really wanted to do. And it goes to a point, Leah, that you made earlier, which is businesses aren't waking up every day and thinking, what can I do to pay women less? I just don't believe that's the case. I guess 3% of them do, which is awful, but 97% of them aren't doing that. And our responsibility, we felt, was to help that 97% to overcome this problem by training and education and awareness and How do you help elevate women? How do you recruit them? How do you retain them? How do you support them?
So, Derek, help us understand a little bit of the laws that have been applied to tackle this problem. And we do not in Utah have an equal pay law, but we do have a wage discrimination law. What's the difference between those two, and does it matter?
Yeah, I'm going to try my best because I'm probably like you. I'm, you know, just trying to understand the legal aspects of it. And my understanding at its most fundamental level is that what we're missing in Utah is a private right of action. So you can make a claim of discrimination based on the Utah Anti-Discrimination Act, but that becomes an administrative process. But what we are lacking is a private right of action in court to take your civil case forward if you have become the victim of discrimination.
So, Derek, I'm interested just right there, like Mara asked you that question. So you went the route of let's help businesses make better choices, right? And then Mara's referencing another path, which would be government making some rules. Do you think, you know, is it like both are necessary? Do you think the path forward of fixing this is better served in more of the private sphere and keeping government out of it? Or do you think what you just talked about, and you're right, I was reading that legality and not quite getting it, but I think you got it. Like the way you explained it seems right the way I understood it. Maybe we do need some tweaks in the law that make a private right to litigation possible.
I think that we need to take a really close look at that for sure. And I was grateful to be able to read the same article that both of you did and have this brought to my attention that perhaps we have this gap of something that we're missing. I think it said that 44 states, including all Intermountain states, have that private right of action. And we certainly, you know, even from a competitive standpoint, from an economic competitive standpoint, don't want to be at a disadvantage, especially when workforce is such an important issue to us. What I mean by that is when I talk to Utah businesses, they say their number one challenge right now is in finding enough qualified and talented workforce. And so if we as a state are at a competitive disadvantage, and I mean, not to mention, you know, individuals being put at a disadvantage, which is really at the core of what we're talking about here. But if we look at the macro level and think that we as a state are at a competitive disadvantage, I do think it's something we need to take a very close look at.
Derek Miller, President and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. And Mara, I love this. I love how we talked about waking up and opening the paper, which I have done.
Yes.
So I remember doing that and being like, oh, this is an issue.
Right.
And what I also love about what we're hearing is it's 97% not a explicit issue, right? It is not the case that people are trying to be bad actors. Mm-hmm. It is the case that there are other variables in play. You know, we kind of talked offline about it.
Right. And letting people, I think all of us, I'm going to speak for myself, letting us off the hook about intentions helps us speak to real problems.
Right.
Because I think first and foremost, we need to recognize that women aren't being paid the same. Like, you have to accept that. So how do you accept that without feeling like you're responsible? Like,
right.
you did something to make this situation. Some nuances that we didn't have time to talk about that are worth consideration in a family-friendly state are women take more time off to care for parents and children often. And 25% of women say that they've had a negative impact. We're only 13% of men. That's just one statistic about how do we make it possible again for everybody to work when they want to work and develop their full potential. I will say, you know, Utah's finished in the bottom of the pile for several years in a row now. So this is an issue I think we do need to keep talking about and tackle.
Yeah, and I love it. We do not have to see ourselves in the problem. We can absolutely see ourselves in the solution going forward. Next up on KSL at Night, Mara, let's get back to politics and talk about the Senate campaign, which is heating up. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Carabello here with Leah Murray. And Leah, the hottest race in town for Utahns is the U.S. Senate seat that's being vacated by Mitt Romney and has, if I remember right, 11 candidates.
That's right.
And it's starting to shake out. And by that, I mean that the race here is to be had first at convention, which is April 27th. I think very few of us believe that any single candidate will come out of convention. But even if they do, there are enough candidates that have signature gathered that we are going to head to a June primary. And so something happened this week that I always want to like tip my hat to a strategic political move. And I think our senior senator, Mike Lee, made a really great political move in which he kind of hosted or joined as the moderator or, you know, whatever, several candidate forums or town halls with potential candidates running for this open seat. Before, he was very careful to say, you know, I'm going to several people. I'm not going to endorse before. I'm just going to sit. I'm going to listen. I'm going to hear and look at how people interact with them. I'm going to just judge for myself what I think. And then maybe later I will or won't. He was pretty vague about whether he would come in on an endorsement. So they're having their convention. They're going to be choosing. I think this brings up two distinct things for us. What was Mike Lee thinking and what did he do? And then I think we want to close this by asking the question, how much does any endorsement?
Yeah.
Right.
So I think you want to go after pretty quickly, I think, what Mike Lee was doing. But I just wanted to real quick, in the article I'm reading in the Deseret News, right, that is so people who are there are citing, and what you hear people saying is, if you want a Mike Lee type, does that make sense?
Right.
So Trent Skaggs basically saying, if you want another Mike Lee Republican, or we've got Caroline Pippen basically being like, I was his staffer, and so
yes,
I would be just like him. So a little bit it's about what Mike Lee does, but I am also intrigued how much love he got from the candidates. Does that make sense? So like they must think that the path forward. And by the way, should we maybe right out of the gate say the people we are talking about who did this with him are Carolyn Phippen, who was a former staffer, Brad Wilson, who is the former House Speaker for the Utah State Legislature, Trent Staggs, who is the mayor of Riverton, and Jason Walton, who is the Moxie Pest Control CEO. And also, I think, a friend of Mike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the four who are in the town hall. So just real quick, is there anything in why these four are giving him all that kind of love?
Well, I mean, I think you said it well when you said they are somewhat arguing they're cut from similar cloth. Not exactly, right? I mean, they're not, they've got some individuality, but particularly when it comes to Jason Walton and Trent Staggs and Carolyn Pippen, actually. So Brad Wilson was Speaker of the House. He's got his own record to run on. But what the four of them have in common, but particularly those three, is to say what you said. If you liked Mike Lee, you're also going to like me, right? And he has a relationship to some degree with all of them. And he's coming again. He asked them a series of questions. It was a curious format,
yeah,
I thought. And the strategy certainly must be talk to the delegates, talk to the strong Republican base, because that's what a move like this would appeal to. That's who would be tuned in to these micro conversations, if you will, these town hall conversations, and would be tuned in to watching Mike Lee participate with other candidates.
All right. So then what's in it then for Mike Lee? Does that make sense? Which is, I think, what you're interested in.
Yeah. Super interesting move for Mike Lee, because he's got an off cycle. And yet now he has this perfect position of maybe being a kingmaker.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, to speak in the language of political communications, he's controlling this news cycle. We're covering an event he created. I've talked before about an ancient adage that I deeply believe in that it's events drive politics. You know, if you can convene, you can set an agenda. And Mike Lee has done a good job inserting himself into this this cycle of U.S. Senate in a way that makes him the elder statesman, someone with knowledge that we should be seeking. And, you know, this is all sort of in positioning. Whether you believe it or not, maybe comes from where you want. And I will say this leads to endorsements. Endorsements are, you can argue on endorsements half a dozen and sixes. And usually what endorsements do is serve to support what we would call your confirmation bias,
mm-hmm,
which comes back to your same question. Boy, I like Mike Lee. Therefore, his endorsement means more or less to me, depending on my position on Mike Lee.
Well, let me ask you real quick before we move to the endorsements, Mara. Do you see anything in the absences? So in the article, it says Lee said he was also willing to appear at events of other candidates, including 3rd District Congressman John Curtis and lawyer Brent Hatch, but did not because of scheduling or a lack of communication. Is that what that is? I mean, like that
yeah,
on the
no,
face?
I mean, it's slightly audacious that he says, hey, don't worry, I'm willing to come with you, right? Like, there's a lovely audacity to that like, oh, well, thanks for throwing me a bone on my own campaign, right? And I can see where John Curtis, who is a current independent elected official who's serving in Congress, is like, no, I'm good. And Brent Hatch, I think, has somewhat taken a path that says I'm forging my own way anyway. If you look at the commercials that are out right now we're in the phase of defining the person and as well as defining their early issues. So you're getting tone and quality from these people. And I think they looked and said, nah, you're not sort of, I don't need your brand in my strategy. He's put them in a bit of I really love this pickle that he's putting him in a little bit by the offer of it. And all of them handled it well in essentially sidestepping it or embracing it. I will say different modes were happened. John Walton, this is where it first got my attention, Leah, is I saw a social media push out by the Walton campaign saying, Mike Lee is co-hosting a town hall with me. I, of course, was like, holy Toledo, how did he singularly become the only candidate that, you know, Mike Lee was holding a town hall with? You peel back the layers a little more, and that's when I found this terrific story that he had actually offered it to several candidates.
Right. No. And all right. So let's get back to the endorsements, right? So basically, Mike Lee is saying, I'm not endorsing anybody, but I do think you're not wrong, right? In this whole conversation, it's an endorsement adjacent, Mara.
Well, yes.
It's an endorsement adjacent. I was thinking of Staggs and his endorsements by Matt Gaetz, who ran a rally for him last week, and Tommy Tuberville. Do those help? Or does it even, like, those are outsiders coming in,
right? Yeah, I mean, Staggs has kind of low name ideas, do many of these. And those are heavy hitters, right? If you're of a certain brand, if you're in the far right firebrand party of the Republican sect, then my goodness, they are performing well. Like, these are the firebrands of the party. He got press out of both of those, which again begs the question, does it matter? Well, it maybe matters at convention because you're not seeing a ton of daylight on issues between these guys, which would be expected. They're all in the same political party.
Right.
So if you're having a hard time deciding and you met them all and their personality didn't differentiate anything for them, then what else do you go on? Well, you say I'm more connected or I'm more hooked in or I can draw these kinds of other powerful people to my issues. So I think it matters in a heavily politicized when you're looking at people who are willing to dedicate a lot of time and energy to the politics of this. It matters. What we do know in the long run, endorsements never hurt you, but they never make the difference.
I love that.
Right?
They never make the difference. So real quick, in our last 20 seconds, Mara, will you be like Taylor and go on the record of who you think's going to be the nominee?
So I'll go and separate 3 from the pack.
Okay.
I think it's Hatch, Wilson, and Curtis who have separated themselves from the pack. I think we'll see all 3 of them in a primary. And then they've got to start differentiating. They're looking a little similar right now. They're going to have to figure out how to connect. And that'll be the game changer. It's really about nuance and momentum, which is harder to manufacture than sort of red meat, right?
Right.
So it'll be interesting. I'm sure we'll cover it some more. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about a hot topic for kids, and that is, what should you be able to bring in terms of technology, cell phones, laptops, into your classroom? Stay tuned. KSL at Night. Leah Murray, Mara Carabello will be covering that next.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Mara Carabello, as we talk about all the interesting things. Mara, I read an article recently, probably in The Atlantic, by Jonathan Haidt, who is a conservative political scholar, right?
Right.
So you may have heard of him, listeners. He's the one who did the moral foundations theories and how our moralities kind of
moral positive things, but they speak past each other,
right?
Which causes quite a bit of the problems that we have in our country. Well, recently he did an article about how cell phones are stealing the childhood of the next generation. So Mara, people have since said he cherry picked research. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
They weren't really persuaded.
Right.
I only read the Atlantic article. The book is coming out in a little bit, and then I'll read the whole book, and then I'll have feelings about his method, I'm sure. But basically the gist of his argument was the kids are sadder. They have more mental health issues. The big chart that was really cool was like, they don't go out to play.
Right.
Right. So it was like some ridiculous number of students used to spend 1 to 2 hours to 3 hours to 4 hours a week, you know, wandering a mall with their friend or hanging out with their friends. And now they just really don't do that. Height said this is a collective health issue and the government has to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Looks like Indiana picked up that challenge and they have passed a law banning cell phones. One of the things Height said was, how do you fix it? And one of the things was no cell phones in school. So basically give the kids 7 hours every day free from no devices at all. Indiana passed a law banning cell phones, tablets, laptops, gaming devices. They've got exemptions for like medical issues, or if there's an IEP, the person needs a technology for their IEP. If there's some kind of emergency, right, they're not going to. And what I kind of like about it is that it's not locking down, like turning off the Wi-Fi, because my goodness, what if something horrible happens and the Wi-Fi is turned off and you can't call for help, right? But basically they are banning them. So I was interested, Mara, we had a conversation a couple weeks ago with Amy Winder Newton, senior advisor to Governor Cox and director of the Office of Families, about kind of the impact of social media, because this is something that Governor Cox thinks a lot about. And I wanted to bring her back and kind of chat about this new kind of development in Indiana and this article. Amy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here. And I think the last time we had a conversation, it was about, you know, how dangerous social media was. And I remember we were talking about, like, what are some rules that we could do as parents, really just to get it out of the hands of our kids. But Amy, what do you think about these moves in Indiana? And there's a few other states that are thinking about it, but Indiana is, I think, the first one that's like, boom, right? Cell phones are now no longer allowed in school. What do you think about that? What's your takeaway?
You know, I think it's a really smart move. I think Indiana is right on when they're looking at the harms to kids, both for their educational and learning, but also just the distraction piece. I mean, it's crazy how they've done studies. In fact, Jonathan Haidt that you mentioned, he's done a study where they have phones like left on the desk or in a child's pocket or out of the room, and how they do educationally. And there's a difference with how close their phone is to them and how they pay attention in class. And I just think, you know, this is something we've got to look at. So let me tell you what Governor Cox has done, because he also agrees that cell phones in schools are not helpful. And so in January, he issued a letter to principals, school administrators, school community council members, and even the Utah State Board of Education. He had separate letters for each of the groups, and sent him a letter and said, help us. Please look at your policies. Discuss with the parents in your community and with, you know, your teachers, and figure out a good cell phone policy for your school. And in those letters, he quoted Delta High School in Millard School District, and their assistant principal, and how he said it was a battle to begin with, but it's been so worth it. Students and parents have all adapted. Our teachers are happier and learning has increased. He also mentioned Evergreen Junior High and Granite School District. They don't allow cell phones to be out any time during the day. So that even includes in the classrooms, in the halls, and the lunchrooms. And he said it's just easier to ban them all together. And our learning has improved. Scores reflect that. The bullying and fighting have decreased. And the students connect with each other in a more meaningful way. And so he says, though, that they really needed the community council to give help them have that support. And that's one of the problems, is we keep hearing these parents fighting against these and saying, well, I need to be able to call my child and find out what size of pants I should buy them at the store or whatever as they're going through their day. And that's concerning to me, that parents don't get why this is so critical.
Yeah. So
I love the approach we're taking in that it's not a universal ban without discussion. It really is relying a little more. I think for me, to bring just some dimensions to the conversation, I think we are relying largely on anecdotal research and not longitudinal. Frankly, I don't think we've had the time. So I don't mean that as an indictment. And I think most everyone believes there's a harmful impact, but it still begs the role of government question. And my question is that I believe over time, and looking at all behavioral sort of behavioral notions, that prohibitions, absolute prohibitions, don't tend to lead to cultural changes. They lead to behavioral changes. And I worry when the government comes with a prohibition when really, if we do think our children will have to negotiate, and frankly, us, we, how well are we doing negotiating having technology in our life? I would love to see us putting as much energy into it being culturally unacceptable to always be on our phone, to be that dependent on technology, to have our relationships. So where does the role of educating us, because this is going to be something in our children's lives, where does the role not just maybe of banning, but in fact educating about why we want to learn self-control when it comes to technology? I know you think about this a lot, Amy, and so how have you guys started to think about infusing a deeper level of understanding and education of our own self-control?
Yeah, I think it's a great point, Mara, because we are terrible examples as adults.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we, exactly. You know, like you look at even in meetings when we're at work, like, are we really putting our phones down and fully engaging? No, we're terrible examples. And so our kids are watching us. And I think that's the number one issue right there. And you just nailed it, is we've got to figure out, how do we make this a culturally unacceptable practice? I will tell you, my husband and I are in Dallas, Texas right now for the eclipse. We got to see the eclipse and it was awesome. And we were at a restaurant last night and I said, oh my gosh, look around. Nobody in here is on their phones. Like, that is crazy. Like, we don't see that very often. And it's true. Like, I started to pay attention when, you know, are people interacting with each other? Like, what are they doing? And that was so rare for me to look around a restaurant and nobody was on their phone. And so, I do agree. We've got to educate. We have to set the example. I mean, that is the most important thing right there, is setting the example as adults on this. And, you know, I gotta be honest, like, our legislature looked at this, not this last session, but the one before. They looked at doing a bill to ban cell phones in classrooms. And, you know, I think it came down to, they decided, hey, we'd rather let local control be the decision makers here, and we'll roll it down to the district level, and they can decide what they're going to do. And the governor's been supportive of that. But, you know, we do need more education on this. We need kids to understand what it's doing to their ability to focus, to their mental health, and those are definite things that we need to do.
Yeah, no, and Amy, I appreciate so much you being here with us. I just got signal. We only have a minute left. I feel like this is a 2-hour conversation and someday we just have to have it. But what I liked about what Indiana did, all of your points, both of you, totally well taken, is it's not the teacher having the fight with the student, right? Like, so it is, look, the legislature said you can't have your phone. The legislature also says you can't smoke on campus, right?
Gave them the power.
Right, you just kind of go, look, we've got some unacceptable behaviors, you know, and not that the big bad is the government, right? But you just like the legislature make those rules. Anyway, but I appreciate the work. Amy Winder Newton, Senior Advisor to Governor Cox, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about this a lot, right? And I think,
well, because it's not going away.
It's not, and we've got to figure it out.
And we do know it's a detriment to all of us. And how do we, and again, I always like to separate the question of the problem from the role of government. Yeah. Whether you're on the left or the right, I think that exercise of identifying specific problems and then identifying who plays what role,
that's right,
is the best policy's path.
So next up on KSL at Night, I want to stay with tech a little bit, Mara. We'll talk about, at the nation's capital, there's a sweeping proposal about what tech companies get to do with consumer data. Stay with us.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Carabello here with Leah Murray. And hey, if you listeners have missed any part of the show, remember we post on podcasts really quickly. So go to kslpodcast.com. Pick on KSL at Night and pull down your favorite segment or listen to the whole thing. Or while you're there, find some other great KSL podcasts. But it's a great way to listen if you haven't had a chance to listen to us live. Leah, you know, one of the biggest policy discussions that America and actually the entire world is engaged with is technology. And how do we use it? How do we regulate it? What rights do we have as users? What rights to these private companies, right? Private companies, what rights do they have as we use? Now, I am going to relish sort of the next sentence because I love it. There was a bipartisan, and I think that's so important. Technology shouldn't be a partisan issue. There was a bipartisan deal that is the focus of attention in the Commerce Committee. The chair, Maria Cantrell, in the Senate and the Republican House Energy and Commerce Committee chair, Kathy McMorris Rodgers, they finally got a deal on this issue. And the issue is one of a proposal in which how many consumer rights do we get with companies like Google, Meta, TikTok, when they use our personal data?
Yeah. So the bill is known as the American Privacy Rights Act. And I kind of want to say, for the record, as a political science professor, let's just be clear, how data is handled is really not my content area of expertise. But I'm interested in how slow the United States has been in managing the information age. So this American Privacy Act is about a decade behind privacy protections that were adopted in Europe, Mara, a long time ago. Does that make sense?
Right.
So what we are talking about is what's an interesting moment and maybe really indicative of how dysfunctional Congress actually is. Everyone agrees we need it.
Right.
Right. Okay. So everyone thought this was something that we needed to have. Everyone is concerned about privacy when it comes to your data. This weekend, I'm having a conversation with some friends about how car companies are sharing with insurance companies data about how you drive. And Mara, I drive fast.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't need my Subaru telling, farmers how fast I'm driving, right? A little bit. So so those conversations we've all been having, right? Like, how did such and such get my phone number? How did this get shared? I mean, the ones that are the most scary is when you're having a conversation with your husband about we're going
to
buy a new car or a new mattress, and all
up.
Of a sudden it shows up in your feed. All of that. So America's been behind. And so this bill is the American Privacy Rights Act. Like you said, it's bipartisan. So it's got support in the Senate and in the House. And so here's just in the bill kind of top line, right? National baseline for how companies collect, use, transfer data on the internet. So kind of an understanding of what that would look like from the company side. To give users the right to opt out of certain data practices. I actually listened to a horrifying podcast about a week ago about if you have a car that has all your information, right? So, and it's wonderful because if you have an accident, you want to be able to get help.
Right.
But let's say there's a divorce. So you are the woman taking the car and it's in the husband's name. And now the husband knows everywhere you're going to be. And then getting the Lexus company to change over manage or ownership, what the name of the person is.
Yes.
Right. That even a restrictive order, if there was some kind of drama, doesn't protect you if you're a woman, is terrifying.
Right.
So women's groups are worried because usually all women have when they leave a scary situation is the car they've got. And if the car is giving data
as they're trying to escape,
I mean, it was a horrifying podcast that I listened to. Man, the things you don't really think about, right? When you're I would like this onboard technology,
sure.
Right? But as it turns out, there can be other ramifications. So the idea that users could opt out of those data practices, right? That they could basically say to Google, don't share my information. I would like to opt out. out. That would help get, so what we just talked about, the targeted advertising out of your feed. I talked about shoes with my husband, and now all of a sudden my feed is full of shoes, right? Yeah. That kind of stuff. And then requiring companies to really only gather as much information as they need to offer specific products to consumers. So the point kind of is, don't collect everything just because you can,
right?
And then you're going to like sell it to other people, right? That's not what we're looking for. All you need to do is really collect data that you need. So what's interesting? So you kind of go like, this all seems obvious, right? And why is it that Europe had regulations like this for over a decade? And what is going on here? And the interesting thing is actually states have led out. So states have rules about what data, financial data you can share, what health data you can share. So a little bit... All right, so let's just dig into the weeds here on this politics of it. A little bit about a federalist system the way we have, Mara. It's the Wild West on some of these policies. Most people probably mostly understood that when we talked about COVID and every state had their own brand of how are we going to deal with COVID. On this, every state's got its own brand and how we're going to deal with privacy protections. So a little bit, the states are doing stuff. So even though there's like agreement, it's like a mass...
Well, and it gets exacerbated when you're talking about transferable technology. Transferable meaning it doesn't happen necessarily tied to a locale, right?
Right.
I take my phone with me when I travel. I take my information. And so this has been a great strategy starting in the 80s by special interest groups, where they realized now it was for very different motivations. In the 80s, it was special interest groups who were frustrated with the federal government not taking an action on, the Second Amendment. But in this instance, I think it's states. This is not uncommon now. States are frustrated that the federal government can't, Congress can't get their act together enough to legislate. So it's not a bad incentive strategy even to say, fine, I'm going to do it myself, knowing that having 50 different laws will cause discord, knowing that having 50 different laws or 38 different laws or 17 different laws doesn't actually work as a regulatory policy.
Right.
But it's a terrific strategy because it forces up a problem that is closer to the federal government having to solve. And to your point that you've said a few times, I think it bears saying that this is a major step forward that we should celebrate. But less than 2 months ago, the EU just put out their second wave. This would have been their first one a decade ago. They put out their second. And just to put it in perspective, when the EU establishes a technology policy, they have to get 20-something independent nation states to agree. I mean, that is extraordinarily heavy lift for the EU. And America's just doing the basics right now, which is like you can't track us and you can't do things without our knowledge. So I guess I'm saying we hope that this becomes the catalyst. It can't take another decade for us to get to second base here.
Yeah, no, and I love like just, again, why Congress is so dysfunctional. So Republican Chair Mick Morris Rogers saying it's a historic piece of legislation. I think I agree. I think it's 10 years, but plant a tree today. The first best time was 20 years ago, but today works too, right? So you're establishing privacy protections. And then the Democrat, a top Democrat on her committee said it's a very strong discussion draft. And you're like, yeah, dude, that's why nothing moves forward.
Yeah, but so critical. I think this is impacting us more and more. And it seems like we're developing an appetite and a strategy to regulate, which will be terrific.
Yeah.
So good stuff here. Stay tuned with us. We have more coming on KSL at Night.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend and also a parent, Mara Caraballo.
Yes, an empty nester. Not that that doesn't count.
Oh my goodness. Does it ever
count? Well, I'm 2 months in. It doesn't, this is preempting our topic, but I'm going to give a shout out to guys, I think you're headed this way. I remember people saying, oh, your kids are grown up. And I'm thinking, one, I love every stage. I feel just as engaged with my kids now as they hit young adulthood. But I mean, I remember my life experiences. I needed that parent even now. I mean, I'm going to still count it now at my age, but
no, I love that. My child is 16, junior in high school, doing all the things and getting ready for college. And she said something along the lines of, I'd like to go to college in Europe. And I said something along the lines of, do they have early college? Could you go tomorrow? I mean,
yes,
like a little bit.
Exactly.
Right? Sometimes the moments are tense, but
you're like, the system's different.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure you could start now.
Yeah, they must take 16-year-olds. Anyway, but yesterday, what I learned from my friends is we are supposed to plan a senior trip. Now, Mara, did you do senior trips?
I did.
Okay, where'd you go?
So, one of the children, the older two, no. The younger two, one just, he chose New York. He chose something.
The city?
Yeah, he did. The other one, you know, this is a really timely discussion. So she graduated last year. So post-COVID, but just a scotch post-COVID. So we went to a really quick... Well, she went on a sailing trip with some friends.
Oh, wow.
And it was awesome. And it was a shout out to the University of Utah professor who, I don't know if he listens, but he did this bucket list of his and they took him sailing on the Caribbean. So she forsook her parents. Is that the right word?
It is.
She turned us
but
aside.
I'm going to say I might have too, Mara. I could go sailing in the Caribbean.
A heartbeat. So the family trip that we planned, we're going on in May. So,
and where are you guys going?
We're going to Portugal and Morocco.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Okay. So I said, oh my goodness, I guess you have to do this. I felt, you know, paying for college was the gift, but apparently you also need
it's
a senior trip.
Not enough now.
Not enough. So I came home from this conversation with my friends and I said to Elizabeth, so apparently we have to do, you know, a senior trip. And I was wondering where you might want to go. And as I'm listening to myself, Mara, this is like the bougiest I've ever sounded here on KSL.
Yeah, I think we should both stipulate to that.
All the privilege. And so she said, well, what are the limits?
Oh, no.
Okay, so I said something like, well, I would prefer not to be harmed. So let's not go places where there's war and probably not authoritarian regimes. So let's stay clear from there. And she said, okay. So then she comes down to breakfast this morning and she says, Greece. I feel like I want to go to Greece. And I thought... Hey, I've never been to Greece. And that seems like she's really into Greek mythology.
Great.
Do you know what I mean? Like she loves doing theater and doing like the old stuff. So I thought that seems kind of perfect. So now I have to plan this thing, Mara. Do you have any tips on that?
Yeah, we'll do those offline. Yeah.
Okay. Give me your agent and how you do this. All right. So, but the thing is, she doesn't need a trip.
Right.
Right. Like, so the answer is... I was reading in The Atlantic, which is making me think of this, right? So I'm planning this trip for this kid, maybe. And I'm reading in The Atlantic, one of my favorite authors, my favorite author, Arthur Brooks, who's got a piece on what we really should do for our kids. Now, Mara, what I really wish is that he had written this, you know, like 11 years ago, because I signed my children up for everything. They were in gymnastics. They were in all the rec leagues. They were, do you know what I mean, doing dance. They were doing every possible. Man, we were busy. And my favorite part about COVID when the lockdown happened was I was like, oh, we have an excuse to not be driving circles around Ogden to all the different extracurricular activity things that I was doing to make sure that they were Renaissance children and they had all the stuff that they needed to have.
Okay. So before we jump into his advice on kids, for those of you who don't know Arthur Brooks, you should look him up. He is a professor, but he's a professor of happiness. And he sort of started, I mean, it's behavioral therapy, but he started this notion of really exploring the truth about what makes us happy and what makes us stay connected. A really great example from his last book about adults is one of the I'm going to make it short. He said one of the most unhappy people that they surveyed was former Nobel Prize winners.
Huh.
And it was sort of to the heart of expectations
and
love and where we really draw happiness, to your point, is not trips. And it's not even to somewhat external achievements. He makes a similar assertion about being a good parent to a kid.
Yeah. So he's citing some Pew data that says the number one desire of parents for their children is not that they're excellent at sports, right? Which you would think all the things I signed my kids up for that it was about the sports. But 94% of parents saying is extremely or very important that their kids turn out to be honest and ethical. And the number one worry, 76% of parents saying extremely to somewhat worrisome, is that their kids might struggle with anxiety or depression. So in short, like you said, he's a professor of happiness. What we want is for our kids to be good people and to be happy people. And then I loved this takeaway. As it turns out, it's not about what parents do, right? Yeah. So it's like all the driving and all the things that I drove them to and all the activities that we did doesn't really have that much of an impact, Mara, on kids. You know, a little bit, there's only so much we can do. My grandpa used to say to my dad, when my dad would ask, like, I'm raising a kid, how do you do that? And my grandpa said, do the best you can and hope.
Right.
Right. And a little bit.
Exactly. That's a little bit what he's saying. Now, he is making a strong argument here for nature, I'll just say. So for those of you like my husband who are nurture folks, you should push back vehemently. But the core of this is that they don't have as much impact as you think. Sometimes it's not nurture. It's mostly nature that predicts how the kid is going to do. So I think that's a disputable. But what's not disputable, I think, well, I hope we're not, is if your goal is virtue and happiness for your kids, he says, keep these three things in mind. One, even a hot mess can be a good parent, right?
I love that.
I think it's a great phrase, and it is really about intent and trying. Two, when you don't know what to do, be warm and loving. That's just a great bit of advice there. When you don't know what to do, be warm and loving. And three, be the person you want your kids to become.
I love that. So that one, first of all, I love all three of these points. But that one earlier, you know, we were talking with Amy Winder Newton about cell phones, right? And one of the things she said was, hey, here's the deal. Put your phone down. Like adults, you both were saying, the adults have this issue. And I wrote down, yeah, Arthur Brooks, right? The idea of if what I want is for my teenager to not be on the phone all the time, then what I need to do is be the person who's not on my phone all the time, right? Yeah. But I also love, like, when you don't know what to do, just be warm and loving. There are times, 16-year-old child in my home, and she's got some drama. Does that make sense? Or my son, who's got a little less drama, he's 14, but he'll come in with, like, questions about. And sometimes I don't know the answer, right? Like Elizabeth will say, Mom, I'm just working through this, and she'll talk, and I'll just go, okay, right? And I love that the answer, sometimes really all you need to do is just be there, right?
Yeah, I love this too, because in the spirit of it takes a village.
Yeah,
you can now see yourself, whether you are a grandpa, a grandma, a cousin, an aunt, a neighbor, you can start to see. I read a study once about how it was a variation on this. What makes kids happy or what makes kids successful and leading towards success? And they had counted the number of positive adults they needed in their life. And what I liked about that is it transcended family unit.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are ideal family units for sure, but many of us are not living in those. And those don't have to be the determining factor as long as there are those of us who are approaching children from a place of love, right?
Right.
That whether you're a parent, for sure, but even if you are a part of their larger village, happiness and feeling loved and secured is a big determiner of success.
Yeah. And I love when he ends this piece, you will make a lot of mistakes, but mostly they won't matter. Oh my gosh. How freeing that is as a parent, because you are trying so hard, you know what I mean, to make all of the right decisions.
That's
and
right.
Really the answer is, you can be a hot mess. It's okay. Did you not get your eyeliner on right today? Like, that works out. You're wearing sweatpants. That's fine. Just making sure that all you have to do is love them. They will be happy if you love them, no matter who in their life, making sure they've got loving people around them, right? How do you say, deploying other grownups in the space to love them, right? All you have to do is love them. They will be happy if you love them. And then the rest sorts itself out. Mara, next up on KSL at Night, you know, talking about summer trips or senior trips, let's have a conversation about summer plans, especially if they're including airplanes.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Caraballo here with Leah Murray. And Leah, summer often means flying somewhere fun on vacation. And do you have your vacation trips?
I have booked flights from here in Utah back to New York to visit family. And I'm going to tell you, two summers ago, we got hung up, like we slept in the airport in Chicago so bad that last year we drove.
Okay.
But now it's enough distance that we forgot how bad flying was.
Yeah,
we're
going to
fly again this summer.
So I'm not an uptight person. It's not my nature. I don't sort of fuss about these things. But I have asked myself does my plane have all of its parts, right? I mean, it is just...
Let's be clear. I'm Catholic. I cross myself whenever we take off every single time.
Yeah. I mean, it has been extraordinary, the amount of flights with problems. Yeah. Now, we've really been focused on bolts and in Boeing, but some other things have been going on in the news related to flying. We have Alex Stone, ABC News correspondent in Los Angeles, here with us tonight. And Alex, tell us what happened recently, yesterday, in fact, with a Southwest Airlines flight.
Yeah, and in defense of the airlines and of Boeing, I think we're just more aware of all of this now.
Pause.
Because
Alex, are you saying that planes' parts fell off always and we just are aware of it now? That makes
I mean, quite honestly, you know, in the world of social media, that now we just see all of it going on.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, I mean, there are maintenance issues and other issues all the time, but we're kind of in this where we're paying attention to all of it right now. What this one was, Southwest flight lifting off out of Denver. Everything seemed normal. They were heading to Houston. They were about 10 minutes into their climb. And then passengers sitting along the wing looking out the window noticed something didn't seem quite right. It looked like the engine was peeling apart and the cover was coming off. And many of the people, by the way, were heading to Houston to see the eclipse, that they were going to be in the path of totality. The blue cover over the right engine, called the cowling, the part that says southwest.com on it, it was peeling away, getting progressively worse, kind of hanging on the leading edge of the right wing, more and more ripping away, exposing all the piping and the cabling and everything else inside the engine, right underneath the cover. The pilots radioed in this.
Let's go ahead and declare an emergency for Southwest 3695, and we'd like an immediate return. We got a piece of the engine cowling hanging off, apparently.
That audio from liveatc.net. They reported in 143 souls on board. They had two lap children, telling rescuers they were coming back with a full flight and to be ready, that they were going to come back quickly. They were going to land fast. They were going to be heavy. They weren't burning off any fuel. They were coming right back.
I think the flaps on the inboard side of the engine, between the engine and the fuselage, ripped off on takeoff. We don't actually see it from the cockpit. That's just what the crew in the back is telling us.
So when they landed, the cover on that right engine was pretty much completely gone. The running theory right now is that when they work on an engine, the covers come up kind of like wings on both sides of the engine, so they can get in and change the oil and check all of the components of the engine and get into it, just like, you know, putting up the hood of your car and working on things in the engine. And then when they close it, there's just little snaps that they clip close, little clips. That may not happen. They may not have clipped it when maintenance was working on it and closed those clips, which once wind got underneath of it, they were able to open up and rip off. Either that or the clips broke. Who knows? This is our aviation analyst, Steve Gagnon.
As soon as there was enough air over the airplane, as it got airborne, those light aluminum shells were actually ripped off the airplane, but it did not come from the inside of the airplane. That engine was still functioning normally.
They landed back in Denver. Everybody was fine. The plane was towed to the gate. The 737-800, as of tonight, is still sitting in Denver getting maintenance done on it. Probably be flying again within a couple of days and flying passengers. If fix that engine, then be good to go. And, I mean, the real aspect of this is the engine kept operating. Nothing got sucked into it. None of the pieces coming off broke a window or did anything like that. This was really cosmetic coming off of the engine, that it looked really bad, but it was really just the cosmetic cover to it. Yeah, to protect it from the elements if it were raining or snowing or whatever. But for that short amount of time, there wasn't a ton of danger based on what was going on, but it looked really bad as you look out the window and looks like the engine is coming apart.
Alex, this just, first of all, how, like, flat affect that pilot was. He's like, you know, yeah, we think the engine's coming off. We can't actually see it, but totally not freaking
but
out at all.
I mean, they know what's going on. It's, you know, like, there's a thing called a compressor stall when an engine, it looks like it has blown up or caught fire. And to those of us who are not pilots or mechanics, it is a freaky thing. It sounds bad. And it happens all the time, and it makes the news, and you see the plane flying along with fire coming out the back, and on board you hear a big boom. But in the end, they're really not that dangerous. So, the pilots, this is why they go into simulators all the time. They know what's going on. They know that cowling coming off the outside most likely is not going to be dangerous. They can just turn around and go back.
So, Alex, real quick. So that I was going to say, you know, why is the airline industry getting away with this? This just seems, but the way you're talking about it, this is not like negligence on Boeing's part. Just the same way, like, I don't know, your door might not close on your car, right? Let's just, so level that for me in that temperature. Does that make sense? Like, basically,
yeah, I mean, probably in this case, more like the hood on your car not completely latching, and then it comes up. And in this case, this wouldn't be a Boeing issue because they don't make the engines. This is either going to be maintenance with Southwest Airlines not clipping it closed, or whoever made this engine, that it would, if it was GE or some other company, that it would be a clip, a broken clip or something there. But, you know, Boeing, they've gotten a lot of flack in the last number of weeks, and some of these have not actually been their doing. This would not be involved. Now, it is on a 737, on a Boeing aircraft. Boeing aircraft had to make an emergency landing, but they don't make the engines. They don't maintain the aircraft. So we'll find out. The NTSB and FAA will look into this of what it was. We don't know if it was a mistake by maintenance or something that broke. But bottom line, it really wasn't all that dangerous. It just looked really bad.
So, Alex, we also heard today that Spirit Airlines, which hasn't been profitable since before the pandemic, says it's furloughing 260 pilots and telling Airbus to defer its aircraft orders as it struggles financially. As profit margins are getting smaller and smaller for even the big guys, is some of this maintenance, or what is perceived as maintenance issues, do you think it's related to the financially tough position that airlines have been in for several years now?
Well, in some ways, yeah. In Spirit's issue, they don't fly Boeing, so it would be an Airbus maintenance issue because they have a number of aircraft that have Pratt & Whitney engines on them, and Pratt & Whitney has done a recall on some of those, and so Spirit has had to ground some of their planes. Similarly to how United has said that it's going to stop pilot hiring because it's not going to get as many Boeing 737s that it thought it was going to get this year, Spirit having to ground some of its A320s, it doesn't have as many planes as it thought it was going to have. Spirit and JetBlue, they thought they were going to merge. Mm-hmm. The Biden DOJ ripped that apart and said that it couldn't go forward. And now both airlines are dealing with financial issues. JetBlue has cut back some of its flying. Spirit has a number of issues. So they are now going to furlough about 260 pilots. They're telling Airbus, we know we ordered your A320s. We don't want them until 2030 or 2031. They're deferring delivery on those, saying give them to somebody else who ordered them. Let them jump the line. And the CEO at Spirit today said, you know, look, the Spirit has got to make these moves to ensure a strong future for the airline. The pilot furloughs are going to take effect in September. They've got the issue of the grounded Pratt & Whitney engines. Pratt & Whitney is going to pay Spirit certain amounts of money to help offset the amount of time that they're not flying and making money on those planes. Spirit's got a lot going on right now, but it has indicated that moving forward without that deal with JetBlue, because it hasn't been profitable since before the pandemic and even before the engine issues, that it's got some headwinds in front of it. You know, they looked at going with Frontier or somebody else trying to merge, but yeah. The current DOJ is against a lot of that and isn't allowing it to go forward.
Alex Stone, ABC News correspondent based in L.A. Hey, thanks for the in-depth coverage on this and staying on top of it. Thanks for joining us.
You got it. Thank you. Have a great night.
So next on KSL at Night, Leah, let's talk about a super cool astronomical event that happened today. We're going to take a different point of view on the eclipse, so stay tuned with us on KSL at Night.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Mara Carabello. Mara, today something huge happened in the sky. Did you look up and look at it?
I tried. I saw clouds.
I was like, I didn't know what that meant. You tried distracted.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have the attention span. No, I wanted to. I remember when we were more in the line a few years ago, and you could feel it. You know, the birds quieted. I mean, it was such a feeling to. I didn't have that today in Utah.
Yeah, not the same as 2017, I think, for sure. My students were all asking me if I saw it. I was like, no, I'm teaching. I did not go outside to do this. But there's a little bit more. And again, my kid maybe wants to be an astronomer, so he's all into it. And if you like looking up, like maybe that's really cool. But there's a little more to it, Mara. Last week, so I work at Weber State University, and we received an email basically telling us how to treat people who had religious expectations or obligations during the eclipse. And I want to just tell you, I did not even know that, just my own bias, right? Like totally did not even know there was a religion piece to this. And then I noticed that Deseret News reporter Kelsey Dallas also talked about religion. So I thought it might be cool to end our show this evening having a conversation about the eclipse that's not about the glasses you buy or whether you were in the totality or not, but about maybe how it, it's experienced by different people. Kelsey Dallas covers religion, sports, and the Supreme Court for the Deseret News. Kelsey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kelsey, let's start with what you talked about in your article, which I enjoyed, which is about what did eclipses mean, you know, in ancient times, right? Like what, how did you say people used to be afraid of it, right? It was kind of like a gloom and doom.
Yes, it was a more ominous situation because ancient people often saw an eclipse as a signal that the gods were angry at them, that they were taking away the sun, which was the source of energy and life. And so there was this feeling that you were being warned about something or you needed to drop to your knees and pray. Of course, prayer can be part of observances of the eclipse today, but it has sort of a different tone than in the past.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure 2024, we shouldn't take this as anger from the gods, to be honest. But so what in digging in, what different faith communities, what did you find out about how the eclipse is celebrated? And what do you know of celebrations that happen today?
There were a variety of events taking place. I think that many different faith groups saw this as an outreach opportunity. So they wanted to provide eclipse glasses, perhaps, to their church members and also community members. Faith groups that were in the path of totality might have hosted folks in their parking lot or on church grounds in order to share their space with others. One cool event I saw that I believe was a church in Texas partnered with a local science museum on Sunday, so yesterday, and had scientists come and train church members to be able to talk to the community about what actually happens with the eclipse. And then there were faith groups that saw it as a significant a religious event, a time for worship. There was a fascinating legal case that was filed out of New York where a group of inmates wanted the right to be out in the prison yard during the eclipse because they felt that it was religiously significant. One of those men is Muslim, and he said he felt that as a Muslim, it's important to be in the presence of the eclipse praying. And so I don't mean to say that every faith group was just having parties. Like there were moments of reverence for this event as well.
Yeah, Kelsey, the thing that I thought was interesting from the email that I got last week is at Weber State was that the Navajo, right, have a very, you know, and you didn't get into this into your article, but the Navajo have, you know, that the eclipse means something for the Navajo community. It's about history. It's about self-awareness. It's about understanding how the sun, the moon, and the earth are all intertwined, right? So, you know, some groups are like, I love that moment of like science and religion hanging out in a parking lot, right? Yeah. And having a conversation about what this looks like. But for the Navajo, very different from our more Western religions, the Navajo have got a different feel for it, right?
Right. And I've done some more research about Navajo beliefs about the eclipse since I wrote that piece last week. And I do wish I represented that tone more because I was talking quite a bit in my article about like sunshine and cotton candy and like let's all join together and have this fun community fair around the eclipse and just take advantage of the land that churches have in order to sort of have a party. And there are plenty of faith groups, Navajo Nation among them, that really do approach a total solar eclipse and other astronomical events as this serious occasion, not scary, not ominous, but just an important moment of connection with the divine, and a connection, I think, with yourself, where it's like, how do I center myself in this universe? And so that's probably what was reflected in the message you received from the school about being aware of students wanting to maybe take time away from a class during the eclipse, where it's like, I need this time to pray or to meditate, to be in nature and just think about the way the universe works.
Kelsey, I was struck by much the same as I looked more into it, the Navajo or the Diné going back generations, this relationship with the cosmos. And I loved the use even of the word cosmos, because mm-hmm. it takes into account how much more we're a part of so many dimensions of existence. And it repeated much the same that you focused on, which is it's a time to stop and pray and fast. It's not a time to go outside or sleep or drink or eat or, you know, engage in other activities. It was a moment. It was this, I love the word cosmic or the cosmos. Mm-hmm. It was this deeply connected moment. And I agree, coming into today as a reflection point, what a tremendously powerful way to view these occurrences.
Now, I will say that I think it helps to be in the path of totality in order right. to really feel that, because I hear you guys chatting about what it was like in Utah. The cloud coverage puts a damper over it, but also just the fact that it was only going to be about 50% moon over sun at its max. And so it just feels like a normal day, or it might just feel like, oh, there's a slight lessening in the brightness outside. But when you are, like, I've been looking at videos throughout the day. I've been looking at pictures from friends who went to the path of totality or live in the path of totality. And it's amazing. It gives you goosebumps. The idea that you're just standing there and suddenly there is darkness. There are lightning bugs flying around. Like, that is amazing. And I think that's what makes you stop and think about, if you believe in God, God's power, sort of the universe that we live in and how small we are in the grand scheme of things.
Oh, Kelsey Dallas, thank you so much. Like, exactly kind of where I wanted to land with this conversation, because I think so much of the eclipse was how much were the hotels in the path of totality, yeah. right? Or how much when you had glasses and making sure if you took a picture and all the very, you know, consumer driven ways that we think about it. But really what the eclipse represents is this moon and this sun and our earth and our role in the cosmos, you know, connecting us, as the Navajo would suggest, back through generations, right? Like, this would have happened always.
I heard a really cool comment by an astrologer who had been chasing and had seen many total eclipses. And he said that his informal, but he had been to hundreds of these, that he said he would say that about half the people that experience it in person, half of them, their response to it is crying.
Yeah. Kelsey Dallas, covering religion, sports, and the Supreme Court for the Deseret News. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for this conversation.
All right, listeners, look, if you were listening to this, you came in kind of late and you thought, that Mara and Leah, they are so brilliant. I have got to listen to them again. You need to get our podcast, whatever app you use, however you download it. We could recommend going to kslpodcast.com. After the show's been aired, just look up at KSL at Night. Don't look up at the sun during an eclipse, but you can look up KSL at Night. Mara, thank you so much for an excellent 2 hours of radio. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. Tomorrow night's a jazz game, so we will be back. KSL at Night will be back the next night.